Welcome to Manager Tools. Today, coaching is self-development, part two. The questions this cast answers are, what is the manager's role in coaching? What do I do when a direct resists coaching? And how can I motivate my directs to be coached?
Folks, it's October, so that means in less than 3 weeks, we'll be hosting the M Conference in Chicago, October 27th and 28th. We do still have a few slots left. We have all the speakers selected, all of them from the Manager Tools community. We want to encourage sharing among the community, and we're trying to build peer-to-peer conversations and communications. Some of our conversations from 2 years ago on our proprietary WhatsApp thread is still going on, and we've created new networks. And so if you're interested in building your network and learning what it's like to transition from being a manager to being an executive, the M Conference is the place for you. I hope you come to the website and sign up.
Aside from the trust piece, the other thing I think that gets missed a lot here is that your direct is going to do most of the work. And most managers don't understand that this is part of coaching, that the direct is going to do 99% of the work. And overall, most managers don't understand coaching. And the two common misconceptions are really that when the manager sees someone make a mistake, they coach the direct.
Right.
Hey, I'll suggest a different approach here. We think of that as coaching. The second thing is managers believing that to coach a direct, they must train that person by being an expert and telling them what to do and how to do it.
Right.
Neither of these things are coaching.
Right.
The first is suggestions on improvement. And the second is, I mean, how could you be an expert on everything? It's a bit ludicrous. Coaching instead is a manager supervising self-improvement efforts by a direct to improve the direct's effectiveness for the organization.
Yeah. Can I just go back and say something? Let me wait, because I think you'll get there. But I particularly have a problem with that second thing, that the manager believes that to coach a direct, she must train the direct by being the expert. I want to, so keep going. Okay. Let's make sure we're on the same page on that.
Yeah. And we'll talk about the first one a little bit too.
Yeah, but okay.
Coaching is a manager supervising self-improvement effort by the direct. And clearly you can't do that by visiting with a direct after a single mistake and imparting the guidance and you know, just making the suggestion, like instead do it this way.
Yeah. Coaching has some strategy. That is an individual tactic.
Hopefully.
That is one task, one thing. Yeah.
There's a difference between, hey, next time don't use FedEx for the shipping, and hey, let's develop a process through which we make decisions about how to proceed. And especially because what we're thinking about is, sure, sometimes we don't use FedEx, well, whatever. But is that really what we want? In that, like, each individual situation, we want to describe a change? Certainly not. And more so, just to think about the future and the sustainability of not only that situation from the manager's perspective, where every single time the manager has to give guidance, more about the sustainability of the direct's efforts.
Yeah.
How can we expect that they could have autonomy or do all the things that they need to do?
Right. Autonomy. I remember when I read, I think it was Daniel Pink talked about the three things that are necessary for a job. Autonomy is one of them. And I have to tell you, the number of managers who are privately a little bit addicted to this idea that my directs are going to come and ask me questions and I'm going to answer all their questions and they're going to know what to do. And it gives the manager a feeling of knowledge. It's related to this issue that the manager has to be the teacher and the trainer.
Right.
And it gives the manager juice every time he or she gets a question, like, I'm smart.
It feels good
to come to me
to impart wisdom.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just so wrongheaded. It's just absolutely horrible.
Well, and it's just exhausting. Anybody who's listening who's had a 3-year-old knows.
Yeah.
I'm not comparing your directs to kids. Right?
Well,
if every single, yeah, why?
But why?
But why?
But why?
But why?
Yeah.
The reason why to go back, right? Because we were talking about the second misconception. The reason why that second piece isn't coaching is because if every coaching scenario involves the manager being the trainer, being the teacher, it creates more unsustainability.
Way more, right?
First, that means managers can only coach on skills they're expert in.
Right.
Terrifying.
Right.
And also, teaching or training by the manager in all coaching situations creates a massive time sink.
Yeah.
For the manager. It's not realistic.
Right.
You know, I do find, to your point earlier, that managers, they like to impart knowledge and wisdom. And so the idea of it, like, oh gosh, it's so cool to get to share what I know. I'm not disagreeing with that in any way. And again, why?
Yeah.
Why? Both as a, hey, you don't want to be in this scenario, but also why would you put yourself in that situation when you know, as managers, we know and we feel constantly that we don't have enough time already.
Right. The other thing we have here going on is a role power differential problem, particularly for frontline managers, where if you're managing an individual contributor, you already made manager and you want everybody to be just like you. There's a little bit of that arrogance in almost every manager, a little bit of that arrogance. Yeah. Yeah. That, well, you know, I did it, so you should do it. And sometimes what that means is you need to go through what I went through, which is dumb. The organization does not want your people to go through what you went through. You weren't forged in the fires of hell in such a way that you became an impenetrable boss-level genius manager. Your people should learn how to be as good as you faster and easier than you did, so the organization can create more leaders sooner, so the organization can grow more and faster. That's right. What part of what your job is. And my big issue is, if a manager starts to believe that every time he or she is going to have to coach somebody, that they're going to be the trainer. And this is why so much coaching didn't happen, is because people, it would sit on people's desk and gather dust because they'd think it will take me weeks to come up with a lesson plan and so on. And so they wouldn't coach. Or the other side of the coin is, if they only coach on things that they're experts on, that they don't have to prepare for every lesson that they give to somebody, you're only coaching them on things you're already good at. That is, you do that 100 times over again. If you repeat that cycle over and over again, you end up with the classic example of a bunch of matryoshka dolls, where the next group is smaller than you, and the next group is smaller than them, and the next group is smaller than them. And that's not good. And look, let's go a step further. Coaching relies on a fundamental principle of all professional learning and growth. Professional, important word there. And that's the adult learning model. The adult learning model relies on both the motivation to learn and action-based learning. Now, what's interesting about that, guys, it's totally adult learning model. If you don't know what the adult learning model, by the way, let me make an aside. I have to make an aside here. Some of you are probably thinking, oh, that's probably the thing that says I'm a kinesthetic learner, I'm an audio learner, I'm a visual learner. I want you to know something, guys. That learning, what is it called? They're learning styles, I think, learning preferences. Yeah. Learning styles and learning preferences have been debunked. If you're listening to the show, and you believe that there's something like kinesthetic learning or auditory learning or visual learning, No, you have to do that for me this way. First of all, the world doesn't revolve around you, Bob. Secondly, those things have been debunked. There have been scientific tests. Google it. You can find it. There have been scientific tests of people given different ways of learning and asking what their preference was and discovering that their outcomes were no better regardless of the teaching method that they used. Mm-hmm. In addition, you'll notice that the misconceptions we mentioned earlier about teaching and also about fixing something when it happens, right? Teaching or training or whatever. Mm-hmm. Those misconceptions are based on the pedagogical model, not the adult model. The pedagogical model, by the way, if you don't know that word, it means how we learn as children. But we're not dealing with children. We're dealing with professionals. And look, guys, it's completely reasonable for you to have spent your entire life in a pedagogical model. That's what you did until you became a professional, until you became a young adult and started working for a living. it's completely reasonable to think that that's what learning is, but it's not. It's children's learning. It's pedagogic. It's pedagogy is what it is. And so we have one of those state changes that is easily missed. You go to high school, you go to college, you go to elementary school or primary school, you go to secondary school, you go to tertiary school, and then you think, well, learning will happen in a school-like environment or with a teacher or with a trainer. No, actually not. And here's another stat for you. 70% of all learning, this is a widely accepted, I've said this 100 times in the last 16 years on manager tools and career tools, and now probably executive tools as well. 70% of all professional growth and development happens in the job. Mm. And look, guys, we deliver training for a living and we're very good at it, but we live and die by the sword relative to truthfulness and ethics. Mike and I are very serious about that. And we're happy to tell you what our weaknesses are. And we know that only 20% of development happens in training session. 70% is supposed to happen in their work. Who's going to deliver that? The company? To everybody? No, it has to be delivered by the manager. What's the primary way we do it? Feedback and coaching. And by the way, taking it a step further, delegating something to someone who is not going to be good at it, and they're going to get a lot of feedback about it, and that's part of the development process. That's the bread and butter of organizational growth. Organizations can't grow if the people in it don't grow. I mean, it's not like, oh, we're all, what, it's like the old joke about the guy selling cars, used cars in Texas. It's okay, ma'am. We're taking a loss on this one, but we're making it up with volume. That math doesn't work. It never works, right?
Yeah.
So managers cannot improve the performance of their directs by doing the work for their directs. In other words, teaching them, training them yourself. You can't do it. It doesn't work. It is putting 5 cents in and getting 4 cents back and saying, look, I got 4 cents. It's a good deal. Pretty soon that flywheel runs down and it'll never run again.
And we know this, right? We know that just because we do something, show it to someone, that doesn't mean they could do it.
Oh yeah. I do this all the time. People say to me, Robin, on the golf course, and I have a pretty good golf swing. I have a pretty low handicap. And I work on my game. I enjoy working on my game. It's my one hobby. It's nearly enough of a hobby to be a vice. people say, my gosh, you hit it so far and you don't swing very hard. They say, how'd you do it? So I like, okay, here's what you do. This. You do this. There's a thing, conservation of momentum, and you need to do this. And this is, you know, and I've looked at your swing and you're probably doing that. And then they take a swing and they did not do what I just said. They did not do it. In fact, it's usually worse in the beginning.
Golf is such a good example of, here, let me show you how to do something. And you obviously cannot do it.
Right, exactly.
That's been my entire experience playing golf.
Yeah.
Do this.
Yeah,
sure. Yeah, that doesn't look hard.
No.
Kate cannot do.
Yeah. Well, take it to the next level. Professional golfers make no bones about saying to people, yeah, I'm not a teacher. I'm good at swinging the club, but I'm not good at teaching other people. Yeah. One of the things I've learned, I learned this great lesson about lessons from a golf teacher. He says, I can tell you in 5 seconds watching a lesson, whether the person, the coach, the trainer, the manager, if you will, that I'm seeing is good at coaching golf. I said, really? He says, yeah. I said, what is it? He says, if within 5 seconds of a lesson, they hand the club to the golfer and get them swinging the club. Because they're maybe not for kids, but for adults.
Sure.
Yeah. And adults, we're talking about the adults. Yeah.
Learn by doing.
Yep.
And as managers, we need to keep this in mind when it comes to our direct's performance. It's why delegation is such an important tool. We give a direct responsibility for something we've been doing, even though they may never have done it before. Delegation absolutely relies on direct's learning by doing. They execute the task. And the same is true for coaching, except for some reason that's not our assumption, or that's, and to your point about late stage coaching, it's not our experience perhaps. And so managers fail to realize that the execution by direct is just as important in coaching as it is in delegation.
Yeah.
And We should probably give an overview of the manager tools coaching model.
Go. Yeah, go.
You know, we set a goal, we brainstorm resources, plan deliverables, act and report. And every step of this model requires active involvement, in fact, full involvement from the direct. Goal setting is collaborative, brainstorming is collaborative, planning deliverables is also
done
there with the direct. Yeah. Action and reporting is done completely by the direct.
Yeah, except that the manager receives the reporting, right?
Sure.
In a one-on-one or in an email or a text or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just say an aside here? I happen to love listening to classical music. And so one of my favorites is Beethoven's Fifth, which is, you know, Roman numeral for five is V. And as it happens, I don't think Beethoven knew Morse code. I don't know that Morse code existed in the 1600s because there wasn't electrical telegraphs back then.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the person who created Morse code decided that V would be ba-ba-ba-ba. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's what it is. Three dots and a dash, right? And when I think of our coaching model, that's how it sounds to me. Ba-ba-ba-ba. In other words, for those of you who don't know it, those of you who do, you already know this. Setting a goal can happen in 2 minutes in a one-on-one. Brainstorming resources also happens within 2 minutes in a one-on-one. Planning deliverables, and you only plan the first week or two, could happen mm-hmm. in 3 to 5 minutes the first time you do it. After that, 2 minutes. And then every week you do the planning of deliverables again until the direct takes it over. So the first three, setting a goal, brainstorm resources, planning deliverables, happen within one one-on-one. The first time you do it, it might take as many as 10 minutes. And then after that, the action and the reporting happens over the course of a week. So in my head, the rhythm, the cadence. Of coaching is ba-ba-ba-ba. Yeah, there you go.
I love it.
That's a way to remember it. Because I have a feeling some people are listening and they think, well, how much time do I have to spend on each one of those?
Yeah.
So setting a goal, 2 minutes. Brainstorming resources, 2 minutes. Planning deliverables, 2 to 5 minutes. Acting and reporting, an entire week. But all by the direct.
Right. From week to week, the deliverables are the responsibility of the direct. They're the ones doing, again, because that's how adults and professionals learn.
Exactly.
And so when you get to action and reporting, the manager's role is limited to working with the direct, usually during your one-on-one for 5 to 10 minutes a week.
Yeah.
And this might last for 3 to 6 months, maybe up to 24 weeks. Each week, the direct might have 3, 5, 7, maybe 10 deliverables. Based on our guidance, we're creating small, short-term deliverables, something that's not going to overwhelm what we think of as their real work. And they probably, at max, would take a day to complete.
Well, most they can schedule it to happen in one day. Some of them take 15 minutes. And that's a huge problem for managers. They're not good. Most of us as managers and executives are not good in breaking down tasks into their component parts to make them deliverables. And how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Folks, we continue to get a lot of business for our client virtual conferences. We do the effective manager, effective hiring manager, effective communicator, and also effective remote manager. We do all of those for clients. If you've got a group of about 15, it's actually cost effective to do it in one group. You can do a group that's spread across the country and save travel. They don't all have to come to one place. And we're going to customize it for you as well, based on what your needs are, what your culture is, what your managers know about management or hiring or what have you. We'll want to talk to you in advance at length to understand what your particular needs are. So, come to the website or email maggie@manager-tools.com and let's get started on a conversation about how we can help you.
The person taking the bites is the direct.
Right.
And if you think about it that way, the majority of work being on them, it becomes immediately obvious that if you had a reluctant direct, it's going to be exponentially harder.
Yep.
They have the vast majority of the work. Are they going to be effective if they're reluctant? Not really.
No.
There are too many possible reasons they could be reluctant. So okay, let's ignore, you know, why they're reluctant and think about from the manager's standpoint, which is where we are.
And there are a couple of things you can do about the manager's standpoint. You were going to use a very high level approach to this because we could give you 17 different subcases, but this is the first cast we've talked about the importance of the direct and their motivation. But we don't talk about motivation very much in manager tools because too many managers mistakenly believe that their job is to motivate directs. Folks, you do not motivate your directs. You cannot motivate another person. All motivation. I'm not making this up. This is settled science and law. You cannot motivate other people. All motivation is self-motivation. They can only motivate themselves. The single greatest thing in hierarchical organizations that generates motivation in the minds of people who, when you survey them, when you ask them questions about why they're motivated, is trust. So look, build trust and then hope and expect that your directs are self-motivated. By the way, also good to hire self-motivated people. And it's not hard to find those people, honestly. You have to interview looking for it, but they'll tell you whether they are or not. But basically, there are two options, right? One is encouragement, which is probably not what you think it is, but on the other hand, one of our favorite words at Manager Tools. And the other is metrics, believe it or not. That I know those sound diametrically opposed. They're really not. And we recommend you use both in virtually all cases, regardless of what the source of the reluctance is. Managers who think, we've said this before, we'll say it again, managers who think that their job is to analyze their directs are in for a short-term and long-term rude awakening. You cannot analyze other people. You're not Jung. You're not Freud. You're not Dr. Phil. as genius as those people might be, your job is not to understand the psyche and the motivation of your directs. Your job is to create an environment where they can choose to be self-motivated. And it's too hard to guess on, oh, well, with this reluctance number four, we need to do X or Y or Z. It's never going to happen, folks.
And creating that environment, in my mind, starts with trust.
Yeah. I mean,
that's how we, you know, foster this environment and create it. And it's really helpful with encouragement too. It's much easier to encourage a person when they trust you.
Yeah.
And even if trust is low, there is a part of encouragement that works virtually in all cases, which is the absence of sanctions.
I think I mentioned this at the start of the show briefly, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What we mean is, coaching is about improving performance. It's not about demanding performance. If we demand performance, the assumption will be that the absence of improvement then comes with a sanction.
Yeah, that's what a demand would be. Right. Yeah.
And yeah, it's like a consequence, but coaching should never be about avoiding the sanctions.
And it isn't. And it isn't. We're not, when Kate says it shouldn't be, it isn't. Okay. You only can choose to make it so if you say to your direct, here's what's going to happen to you if you don't improve. But it's not the coaching that delivers the sanctions. It's not. And that's, it's just a huge misperception. We're asking for and encouraging the direct to get better. Failure to achieve a coaching goal is never tied to sanctions. Whether you're coaching a top performer and they just don't get it, or you're coaching a bottom performer, even in late stage coaching.
For most directs, failure to succeed in a coaching process leaves them right where they started.
Exactly.
And so if you're right at the starting line, if we don't have success in this coaching model engagement situation,
right?
Hey, guess what? Where we are now is where we will be at the end of the process.
Actually, in the last couple of years, I've learned something interesting about this. Okay. So they're actually better off even if they don't achieve the goal because they're doing 100% of their work and 95% of their time.
Oh, so we've gotten some extra bandwidth.
Yeah. Capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So for all but late stage coaching. There's no position of risk.
Right. Yeah. And so if I'm your boss, Kate, I would say to you, hey, look, I want to help you get to the next level here. No risk. I mean, I believe you can do it. In fact, I don't even think you have to breathe hard doing it. And in case you're wondering, do I think this is a bad thing? No, I think it's a good thing. And I know enough about getting you there that I think we can work together and we can get you there. And there'll be all kinds of benefits. And if it doesn't work out, if life throws you a curveball or throws me a curveball or the business changes, or we just discover that in some way the path that I thought we might be able to go down doesn't work, no skin off either of our noses, okay? Mm-hmm. But we are obligated to try to improve even when we don't end up improving. I'm going to say that again. We are obligated to try to improve, folks. This is the nature of organizations. We are obligated to try to improve even when, in the end, we may not end up improving.
Yeah. It's a professional responsibility obligation to know that we all have room for improvement and to strive towards those upper levels. And this means that the majority of coaching scenarios have no risk for your direct. And failure to achieve whatever the goal is, isn't going to cause a strike against you.
Right.
Maybe that we haven't improved. Okay. This person's still valuable to the team. And we have to communicate this to our direct, because in the same way that we previous to this cast may have existed under this misconception, your directs do as well. And so we have to say to them, I want to help you get better. Even if this doesn't go well, you'll have learned a lot. Maybe you'll have some more bandwidth. To your point, there's no punishment for failure. Tell them there's no punishment for failure. If they get 90% of the way and don't make it, which, okay, maybe real work intervenes or real life intervenes, all this kind of stuff, it could happen. How is that a time for sanctions?
Yeah.
Or, yeah, you know, 90% negative.
90% of the way there. Right.
Yeah.
The old joke about 90% getting 90% of the way there is we punish the 10% not achieved.
Yeah. Hey, you did super, super great, except not so much.
You're in trouble.
And it might be normal for a lot of us to assume that the absence of sanctions in the event of failure doesn't hold for late stage coaching.
I disagree. Yeah, right. That's what you're saying, that's what people think. That there will be sanctions for late stage coaching, but it's different. It's more risky, right? But
again,
this is wrong. This is a common misconception that's wrong. And you ask, okay, wait, late stage coaching, they fail, they're going to get fired. No. It's possible, because in the event someone's performance warrants late stage coaching, their failure to improve due to your coaching effort is not what is going to be sanctioned. What will be sanctioned, it'll be used as proof against them. Don't get me wrong. But what will be sanctioned is their overall performance, because the organization doesn't want any manager ever to go into late stage coaching, right? What will be sanctioned is the overall performance, not the coaching effort they make or don't make, or that you make or don't make. So by the time someone gets a late stage coaching, there's going to be ample evidence of performance weakness to justify termination. Mm-hmm. That's it. It's already done in the minds of the organization when we do late stage coaching. We recommend that, because you are the bridge between between the organization and the individual, because you're going to engage with this individual, you should take the heart and mind of the individual into account, and you should be on their side. We recommend you take their side and not agree with them on everything, but try to help them get to a place where they can keep their role. Because let me tell you, there's only one thing worse than firing a person, and that's keeping somebody around who doesn't earn it, that then causes problems for everybody else and makes the organization less effective. But if you don't throw up the night before the organization tells you you have to terminate somebody, you don't have the heart or the gut to be a good manager. Mm-hmm. The misery you're going to cause, the discomfort in their family, that's horrible. You have to do it. It's why you get paid extra as a boss. But it is not the failure in coaching that causes the sanction of termination. What absolutely would be sanctioned is a direct who knows her performance is suffering, who then refuses a manager's offer to coach her to better performance. That's a problem, right? Because we're all obligated to get better.
Yeah. We've heard managers talk about it like this during late stage coaching. You know, you can't lose with this coaching engagement. If you don't perform well during the effort, it's not failure that will be the problem. It's the long-standing performance issues we've repeatedly talked about. That's the problem, not the coaching.
Right. And not your engagement in the coaching. But if you don't do well in the coaching, this will prove that all that other performance is of a piece.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to say the performance hasn't been good enough. The organization is going to say that.
The only way you can actually lose is to not be coached and to stay at your current performance level without attempting to do better. That will be seen as a lack of interest in improvement, which combined with present performance and all this past data around lack of performance that's a dead serious issue.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. As a manager, we should want our direct to excel in the process.
I'm going
to
say that a little bit differently. If you're a really good ethical manager, it's not a question of should want. You do want. And if you don't want your direct to succeed, you're not a highly competent ethical manager. Mm-hmm. I'm going to turn it on its head and say, I'm going to say if then this, then that backwards. Here's the test for you. If you're an ethical, professional, competent leader, you want your direct to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or put differently, if you look in the mirror and say, I really do, I want him or her to succeed, you win. We like you. If you have to ask yourself whether or not you really want them to succeed or not, you're missing the point. You're asking the wrong question. The leverage should be with your direct. Mm-hmm. Because it's expensive to replace people, by the way. Yeah, you may have to fire them. And by the way, if you fire them, it's going to be your fault. Let's be clear. If you get somebody promoted, it's their win. When you have to fire somebody, it's your loss. Because the organization is going to have to spend time and money, much of it yours, to replace that person.
Yeah. And, you know, if you share all of this with your direct that, hey, if we go into this coaching and it doesn't go well, it's not a sanction that's applied about the coaching. It's because of this past lack of performance and share that with them and share with them too, that you want them to do well. You want them to excel. You want to save this situation.
Yep.
It may not feel like we're suggesting you encourage them with this, you know, here's the information about what's going to happen. It may not sound like encouragement, but it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've seen managers do this and say, look, there's no problem if you don't make it through this, but if you don't make it through this, all the other performance is going to be used against you and you're going to be in mm-hmm. trouble. So this is your chance to be excited about doing well. This is your chance to do better. And I want you to do better. And I'm going to be with you every step of the way. This is my fight along with yours.
And when we say it like that, it does sound encouraging.
It does. Thank you.
Which we urge you, encourage your directs, you know, all the time, weekly, as often as you can. And you can probably easily come up with your own words of encouragement.
Right.
And help them to have courage or hope or belief, right?
Yeah. That's the... I'll tell you one. I say, I love you, man. I mean, I don't know why love has been banished from the workplace. Say, I love you. I'd give you a kidney. Don't say that if you wouldn't, by the way. And if you wouldn't, you need to think again about life and the universe. I happen to like the word encourage. It means to give someone courage or hope or belief. And if you don't know in the original formulations of the Manager Tools Trinity, the purpose of each one of the four parts of the Trinity is to encourage. To encourage effective relationships, to encourage improved performance, to encourage improved capability. I mean, right down the line.
Yeah. If you're willing to spend a few minutes each week guiding your direct, what would stop you from saying something like that? Giving them words of encouragement. The only thing I can think of is a desire not to encourage.
Yeah. Well, I would argue some managers say, well, that's not important. That's not how I learn. That's not how I grow. So I'm going to do what makes sense to other people, the golden rule. And mm-hmm. I will tell you, it has been our experience when people feel either that they're being helped or that they are at risk. They want as many people as possible to tell them, I believe in you. I trust you. I want this to work. They want encouragement. In fact, there are plenty of people, top performers, you don't need to encourage me. Yeah. Well, those people have been wired up to brain meters. And when people say things, they still get the dopamine drip going on. So they're just being blustery. And they're telling a little white lie to protect their own self-image. And we ought not to let them do that.
And let's not let our little white lie about ourselves be inflicted on others. Yeah. Because it's so easy. You say, I believe in you. I want you to succeed. I understand that you might fall a little bit behind, but I'm on your side, here for you. I appreciate your efforts. I know this is hard and we're all in this together. I trust that we can figure it out together. I know you're capable and I want you to do your best.
Yeah. And then the other, this is all just encouragement, right? But that doesn't even take into account all the positive feedback you can give them when they meet their daily and weekly deliverables and deadlines. Mm-hmm. Hey, can I give some feedback? When you get this done, it shows me you're working hard. When you meet your deadlines, I'm proud of you. When you finish stuff early, I get excited that you're ahead of schedule. When you tell me in advance you're going to miss a deadline, you look and sound like a professional.
It sounds lovely, doesn't it? Yeah. Even those of you who are listening, you might be having dopamine, even though that wasn't about you.
Oh, that whole thing. The fact that people actually say to us at our effective manager conferences, he just gave me positive feedback about something that was made up that I didn't do. And I actually feel good.
I feel good.
That is how desperate we all are for encouragement.
And positive input.
Yeah.
And so we talk about feedback, which
right.
Crucial. As for metrics, because we're, you know, talking about this specific piece.
We're moving from encouragement to metrics now.
Yeah. Two things, right? Encouragement and metrics. And as for metrics, okay. It's simple professionalism.
Yeah.
What does your organization care about that it doesn't measure? Nothing.
Zero.
Right? If we care, we measure for your team because you represent the organization. If you're going to coach someone, you must be measuring the process and outcome. And think about it. This is so important. And the organization cares.
Yes.
And so we apply metrics, not because of potential negative outcomes, but because professionals measure anything that they value.
And you can actually say, when people say, well, why are we measuring this? Because I care. Because the organization measures things it cares about. We value this. We value this effort. We're not looking to put you in jail. We're trying to measure your success. But we can't avoid measurement because people fear measurement and then end up at the end having a success, but having no way of proving a success.
No.
Yeah.
Greatest management principle in the world. The things that get measured get done.
Yep.
And the MT coaching model is both light and heavy on metrics.
Yep,
it's agreed. Heavy in the sense that we recommend you measure your direct's performance on each task by making them deliverables and on each week of efforts included in the weekly reporting during your one-on-one.
Right.
It's incredibly light on metrics in the sense that there are no sanctions associated with failure. It's the difference between saying, I want you to keep track of your batting average after every game, but I'm not going to fire you if your batting average isn't above the Mendoza line.
Yeah.
Metrics aren't about creating data for failures, despite what HR may say.
Yeah.
They're about measuring the success we have. And the success here should be when we're coaching, but also, you know, earlier we were talking about late stage coaching. So every coaching engagement, the success should be a continued relationship with and level of input and employment for your direct.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big success.
You know, it's funny. I'm sitting here at the end of this. We've been going on for over an hour. We both thought this was a one-part cast.
Oh, yeah.
And we got started. And I have a feeling more and more in the future for MT. And of course, you and Sarah are doing it now. I'm just a guest on the show. But it's more and more that when you have all of this stuff in your head, you begin to see connections. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, people in the field, I was just in Philadelphia with a coaching client, and she said to me, it's amazing how your stuff connects. I said, it's not amazing. It's a derivative effect of the underlying principles. And it's not just me. It's how organizations and people are designed to work. It's like the invisible hand in economics.
Mm-hmm. And once you make the connections, it's hard not to connect, to go say, okay, well, now we have to go down this path, because now that we've cleared all the brush from this path that we're currently on, we can see the other 17. Path. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Good analogy. Yeah. So I'm going to summarize here. The managerial coaching model relies on our directs, guys, for their own self-improvement. We managers, it's our job to guide them, to help the direct achieve, and to make sure their growth is benefiting the organization. We don't need to guide our direct to help them improve in areas that don't help the organization. We can't do it for them, so it's about them. But we can know the process, teach the process, guide the process, encourage the direct, and measure their progress. That's about as far as you can go with adults. Yet again, I get to say, but so few managers do this, you'll be seen as highly effective when you do it. That's it.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, it's a treat. It's a treat to be back.
So fun. Thanks, everyone. We'll be back next week with a new topic.
Thanks, everybody.